All right, well, here we are, Father's Day. As I kind of said in the email, you know, I somehow got Father's Day. Someone makes sense, whatever. I don't feel like any great example or anything, but anyway, so here we are, Father's Day. A few weeks ago, we were having lunch with some friends, and they're expecting their first child. And so we were just sort of talking about the different things, and I unhelpfully, I'm sure, described parenting as one failure after another. And as pessimistic and defeatist as that sounds, I would actually challenge anyone who's tried to raise kids to, dispute the truth of it.
There's the proof right there.
We go. Can I? I'm just doing something here, okay? All right. Can I do this? Anyway, one failure after another. So today, rather than trying to do like a top-down dissemination of my parenting brilliance, I'm going to just share a few kind of insights via some pop culture references and some Bible stuff in order to just think about the growth I've experienced as a father, as a parent, and about the things that I've learned from my own son and the world that he sort of opens up to me, which is a world that I would normally avoid. As you'll see as we go through this, which I think has made me a better parent, a better son, a better partner, and I think in general a better person. So I'm going to try very hard to keep this from turning into something trite or overly saccharine. I'm not going to get up here and say that my son taught me more than I ever taught him. After all, when he showed up, he did nothing but eat, sleep, poop in his diaper. Now he can walk, talk, read, and most importantly, use the toilet on his own. And so I can't, of course, take all the credit for all of that, but I do feel like I was an important part of that development. I do, however, recognize that because of him, I am a different person, definitely humbler and more understanding of other parents, especially when their kids are screaming. I'm proud to say I was flying last week, and I did not scowl at a parent with a screaming baby, which is not what I would have done before children. Instead, I gave the sympathetic, I know, it's okay, don't worry about it, you know, because it's not that big. So one of the ways, we're going to kind of go through this, one of the ways that my son Atticus, who you all saw here a minute ago, and I bond is usually through media, so movies, music, books. He's been listening to music since he was in utero. We read books together every night, and he's been going to the movies since before he can walk. This is his first time at the movies. He's leaning on me because he couldn't walk yet. And the result of this is that we've watched most of his favorite movies many, many, many times. And for someone like me, who I won't say earns a living, but comes close to earning a living, teaching and writing about film, these multiple viewings often result in my tendency to analyze movies that don't always hold up to close readings. Yet, there are some kids' movies that really do, especially Pixar movies. I can't help but see a movie like WALL-E, if anyone's seen it, as a prescient vision of our future, especially with the proliferation of companies like and apps designed to make sure that we never leave our couches. I'm looking at you, Amazon, Skip the Dishes, Netflix. The Cars movies are interesting contemplations about the way in which this sort of Western obsession with newness over the last century has resulted in a culture of planned obsolescence, leaving a century's worth of outdated technology and infrastructure to slowly decay in remote locations, like Radiator Springs. And the Toy Story movies, with their constant return to this lost and found narrative, evoke childhood anxieties around transitioning into adulthood, especially Toy Story 3, which we watched last night and is a knockout, but anyway. And of course, there's Inside Out, if anyone's seen that one, which is so densely layered with regard to this sort of difficult navigation of childhood emotion that I could probably talk about just that one for another hour, but I won't. I'm not going to because we're going to talk about the Lego movies today. Specifically, the Lego Batman movie. And the reason is, what makes those movies so interesting is that they take place within this logic of childhood, which is a refreshing place to visit, I feel like, as an adult. And so what I mean by that is that their character motivations and even the narratives follow the way that a child or a group of children, such as the one in the back there, might work through a story while they're playing. The films are entirely about the act of play. Yes? Okay. So they're all about the role of play. In the first movie, we find out the main villain in the movie, President Business, is actually the central boy in the movie's father. And the main hero, is this always positive yet comically inadequate average guy, is a manifestation of this central boy in the movie and in his own insecurities as he moves from childhood to adolescence. Part of this journey, so the movie takes place sort of in an animated and a live action way, but part of this journey is this sort of quasi-Oedipal narrative, albeit without the incest, as the son must defeat his father, because the father has co-opted the child's toy, Lego, to construct these complex models and dioramas, which he makes permanent using crazy glue. Meaning that the father has taken what should be objects of play and vehicles for imagination and turned them into restricted objects to be viewed and not touched. Playthings that cannot be played with. So the narrative, which as I said goes back and forth between the sort of animated portions that are connected to the son's imagination and the live action sequences where we get the sort of story behind the story about the son trying to break into his father's world to get his attention and to infuse the regimented adult world with a sense of childishness through play. The ending is a little bit more upbeat than it was for Oedipus. The son doesn't have to kill his father and marry his mother, because nobody wants to see that movie. But the son does come to overcome his father's resistance by teaching him sort of the joys of play. The son teaches the father. So when we engage with these Lego movies, we have this opportunity to view the world through the eyes of children. And that doesn't necessarily mean like a simplistic view of the world, but rather it's a simpler approach to complexity because the problems tend to be faced with a certain degree of optimism, or at least what we could call good faith. So I want to take a look at just a moment from the Lego Batman movie that I think that gets at the heart of this sort of complex simplicity or simplistic complexity, whatever you want to call it, that I'm talking about. So we're going to look at this just kind of short clip. There's sort of, this is the first introduction of the new police chief to Gotham City, who is, her name's Barbara Gordon. In the audience, the guy who keeps responding, that's Bruce Wayne. If you don't know, Bruce Wayne is Batman, spoiler alert. And so I just want to kind of look at the way this plays back and forth, and we're going to think about it in terms of bigger themes and everything that's going on. So here we go.
I'd like to ask all of you a question. Are you fed up with crime? Yeah, we're sick of it. Then let's talk about real improvements that will end the cycle. I have a pilot program that I'd love to share with you.
I want to hear all four points.
It's called
I Am Ready.
It Takes a Village.
Best opening to a title ever.
Not a Batman.
Where?
Look, Batman's been on the job for a very, 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 very long time.
He has aged phenomenally.
However, despite all the great work Batman has done for us, Gotham City is still the most crime-ridden city in the world.
He hasn't captured
Riddler. He hasn't captured Bane or Catwoman or Two-Face or any of Gotham's other villains.
He's not good at his job.
Including the Joker.
She's making a lot of sense.
Excuse me. I'm so sorry. Excuse me.
Yes.
Hi, Bruce Wayne, billionaire, wanderer, gallivanter, playboy, Gotham's most eligible bachelor like 90 years in a row.
I know who you are, Mr. Wayne.
Bet you do. Quick question. What is your problem with Batman? And also, what the heck, dude?
I'm glad you asked, Mr. Wayne. I'm not a Batman hater. But we don't need an unsupervised adult man karate chopping four people in a Halloween costume. We need to take what's good about Batman and drag it into actual laws and proper ethics and accountability.
I hate everything you just said.
Because my dream is for the police force to team up with Batman.
Where?
Wouldn't that be better? And I know that together, the world's greatest detective and Gotham's finest could clean up these crime-ridden streets. Forever.
Everybody get down.
All right. We're going to stop there, as exciting as that was. okay, so what's really interesting about this is the way we have these two conflicting worldviews coming into direct competition with each other. We have the sort of heroic ideal, which currently, or in this film, takes the shape of Batman, or superheroes in general. The sort of superheroes, the lone figure who uses whatever means necessary to accomplish their version of justice. This character type is, of course, nothing new. Superhero stories are just kind of the latest incarnation of Greek myths, like Hercules, Odysseus, Jason, and the Argonauts, which then became tales of knights and kings before morphing into, say, cowboys, soldiers, and now superheroes. The superhero, however, has a particularly sort of small-c conservative and Americanized iteration of the myth, especially if it's sort of narrative of invincibility and infallibility. So superheroes may get hurt or misunderstood from time to time, but ultimately they prevail, and their version of justice will be served. The air of American exceptionalism in this type of hero is reinforced constantly by positioning viewers on the side of heroes. We are aligned with their choices, motivations, and actions so that we don't have to deal with doubt about whether or not the hero might be wrong or actually a villain. Religion, incidentally, operates in a similar way. While every other character in the movie, not just this movie, but most superhero movies, may be struggling with a masked figure who violently assaults other people without any regard for individual legal rights, we see the superhero as simply misunderstood, since we are told to believe that the hero has this unimpeachable sense of right and wrong, and that things will somehow be worse if he, because it's usually a he, but she sometimes too, is not allowed free rein. If the haters in the movie would just stop being so reasonable and get on board with this weirdo in tights, everything would be fine. The superhero narrative tells us that we should accept the, what Barbara Gordon calls, unsupervised adult male karate chopping poor people in a Halloween costume. This may be my favorite description of superheroes of all time. So what's great about this movie, what we get in here, is that they're sort of breaking this proverbial fourth wall and forcing us as an audience to not only be suspicious of the Batman character in this movie, but also the entire sort of superhero genre and mythos. Barbara Gordon articulates that not only the very figure of the superhero is ridiculous, it's also deeply troubling because, as the film points out, superhero narratives are this sort of perfect primer for this ideology of what we call in the real world fascism. I know it's a big F word, but stick with me. So now, I know that Batman doesn't have superpowers, but he still sort of represents this exceptional superhuman figure. What a cultural theorist like Max Weber, you don't need to know that name, but he would have termed a charismatic leader in whom populations place undue trust. Superheroes with their sort of superhuman strength are these figures, and the only way that we can accept someone with superhuman strength assaulting someone without it is if we believe that the hero is working for the betterment of the world. Hence, we put our trust in these figures because we view them as exceptional, not only physically, but also emotionally, rationally, and ethically. That's the most important one. We do the same thing with nations, by the way. Why is the United States allowed to have the largest nuclear arsenal in the world, while North Korea or Iran, it's very important that they can't even get one bomb? It's because we trust the United States not to use these bombs, despite the fact that the United States is the only nation that's ever used a nuclear weapon in combat. I suppose we just believe that they will use them well. Maybe we don't believe that as much anymore. Anyway, by the way, I'm not advocating that North Korea or Iran should have nuclear weapons. I'm just going to put that on the record here, thinking maybe we should all have fewer nuclear weapons in general. But
it's a good question. Why do these countries have them and not these countries?
Right.
Right.
It is an interesting question. Yeah. But I'm going to leave it at that. So politicians also play this game, obviously. Perhaps we don't like everything a politician does, but we continue to support them because we think that they're heading in the right direction eventually. To use a term from anthropology, there's this sort of tribalism that sets in with regard to politicians and political parties, an entrenchment that manifests in support despite our better judgment. And the extreme outworkings of this, of course, is fascism or totalitarianism, which is the exceptional individual. Fascism is usually built around the exceptional individual that breaks all the rules in the name of some greater good. They tend to surround themselves with affirming voices and narratives about their exceptionalism that makes them, about how their exceptionalism makes them understood by the establishment, so that followers will give them carte blanche with regard to the actions that they take. Media narratives are also vital to all of this because they allow for the construction of the public persona. It also helps if there's an easily identifiable villain that the leader can amass support against. So whether that be Jewish people in the 1930s Germany, communists in 1950s America, immigrants at really any time, or easily identifiable supervillains like Lex Luthor, the Joker, or Thanos. So as a side note, while fascism is sort of the extreme end of right-wing ideology, totalitarianism as a result of sort of political hero worship is not limited to any end of the political spectrum. So I'm not picking on one side or the other, just to point that out. You can have sort of totalitarian left-wing leaders as well as right-wing. So that's all, just a side note. All right, coming back to Lego Batman, now that I've given you a crash course in everything else, the reason that this movie is able to perfectly articulate its message about sort of questioning and or investigating the superhero narrative is because it operates with this logic of children. And so it has this ability to be totally blunt as only children can be, much to the humiliation of their parents, very often. The film is viewing large, intractable issues of morality and exceptionalism through the lens of kindergarten ethics. And it is the innate and overwhelmingly powerful sense of childhood fairness that dictates the discourse in this scene. So is the law in an ideal situation fair? It should be. Now we can get into a long debate about whether or not laws are always fair, and we'll do that in a little bit. But for now, let's set that aside. So if the law is, if not totally fair, then at least reasonable, more reasonable than a grown man in a Halloween costume, then it stands to reason that to operate outside of the law is a bad thing. Hence, Batman operating outside of the law makes him bad. Yet, he is working for good, so he cannot be entirely bad. So what do we do with this figure? Well, like any child learning to share, we have to come to a compromise. We take what's good about Batman and marry it to what's good about the law. This is Barbara Gordon's suggestion. So a little bit later in the film, we sort of see this kind of thing playing out. So this is much towards the end of the film. If you haven't seen it, I'm sorry, spoiler alert. But we're going to see how the two sides kind of come together and what that results in.
Okay, BRB, guys. I'm going to go defuse that. Joker, please help us.
No, I'm not going to help you.
Joker's
the beast. If this city is destroyed, I'll die knowing I'm the greatest city.
I'm there. I can know it.
Shut up, Joker. If there's no Gotham, then I'll never get to fight you again. What? You're the reason why I get up at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and pump Iron Man until my chest is positively sick. You're the reason I've given up a life spent with Russian battling as a maniac to threaten my life. And if it wasn't for you, I never would have learned how connected I am with all these people. And you. So if you help me save Gotham, you'll help me save us.
You just said...
Batman and the Joker.
Joker.
What do you say?
Joker.
You had me. Shut up.
How are your abs, bro?
Too much flab, not enough ab. Why?
Because I need you to crunch them. Citizens of Gotham, we need all of you to join us and help bring this city back together.
All right. So the overarching lesson of this entire movie can be summed up in terms of what I was calling kindergarten ethics, right? Batman learns to play nice by learning to work as part of a team rather than as this lone exceptional hero. Barbara Gordon, who now shows up, she's dressed as Batwoman, not Batgirl, as we are told in the movie. So she's, as the representation of the law, also moves closer to accepting Batman as a flawed but well-intentioned character. In the end, the only way for good to overcome evil is for the good guys to work together. Ultimately, the good guys are able to enlist the help of the bad guys, as we see as the film ends, with Joker helping Batman in a not-so-subtle metaphor to bring the city together, literally. So in the real world, we call this sort of arrangement democracy. And while it's not perfect, it's supposed to be our antidote to monarchies and fascism. Depending on the version of democracy being practiced, that doesn't always work out, but at least we get to retry every few years, which, along with rights like freedom of speech and the ability to assemble and protest, I think is preferable to the unquestionable exceptional figure that will be in power indefinitely, someone like Batman. Okay, so we talked about a movie a lot. We talked about movies a lot. And I'm not done yet. We're going to come back to something else in a minute. But I want to just think about one of the more famous passages in Scripture that talks about children. So in Matthew 19, Jesus is talking to some Pharisees about divorce when a bunch of kids show up. And so I'm reading this out of the King James Version, so sorry about the Shakespearean tongue here, but the translation here, I think, just captures a lot better than some of the later translations do. Kind of a really interesting point that I think gets left out of later translation. So, here we go. Then were there brought unto him little children, that he should put his hands on them and pray. And the disciples rebuked them. But Jesus said, "Suffer little children, and forbid them not to come unto me, for of such is the kingdom of heaven." So other translations, later translations, say, "Let the little children come unto me." But for me, there's something really interesting about the use of the word suffer. It's antiquated, of course, in this usage, which dates to about the early 17th century. But in this usage, the term is more closely associated with allowing or accepting. Yet, as I suffered through the many, many entries related to suffering in the Oxford English Dictionary, there is a recurrence of the allowance being made to something inconvenient. So one must suffer fools and so forth. You've probably heard that term. So the translators, and I'll refer to the translators because I don't know enough ancient Aramaic to know exactly what Jesus was saying, but they're capturing Jesus' acknowledgement of the disruptive nature of children in a way that is more effective than the word "let" manages to do. Yet despite this inconvenience, Jesus shows grace with the rest of the sentence. He says, "Forbid them not," and most importantly, he states that that children are the kingdom of heaven. Again, I love this translation here because of the way that it frames this complex idea of kingdom of heaven. In a lot of other translations, the phrase becomes "the kingdom of heaven belongs to such as these," but in the King James it says "of such is the kingdom of heaven." So the word belongs is where I get caught up here, because I think it diminishes the idea of what Jesus is talking about by making the kingdom of heaven a thing that can belong to someone, even children, rather than a manifestation of existence. So I won't get too caught up on the notion of kingdom, which is also a highly problematic metaphor for reasons I've been discussing. But I think it's for now we can simply accept that it was a useful metaphor in Jesus' time and at the time of the translation, and we can sort of leave it at that. I want to think about the idea of what, when Jesus talks about heaven, what that might mean. Now, if you're like me, you were probably taught, you were probably taught that heaven is this place that you go after you die. Yet every time Jesus talks about the kingdom of heaven in the Gospel of Matthew, it sounds a lot different, a lot less systematized, and a lot closer to us. So he refers to heaven in many parables, comparing it to a mustard seed, an empty field, a great feast. He references the kingdom of heaven all over the Sermon on the Mount. And at one point he tells the Pharisees that they have locked people out of the kingdom of heaven with their false teachings. And at another point he promises us the keys to the kingdom and frames it as something affected by our actions right now. That's another whole complicated issue that I won't get into today. All of this to say that heaven, or the kingdom of heaven, or the kingdom of God as it's called in other gospels, feels less like a destination than sort of a state of being. And by that, I'm not denying any notion of the afterlife or any of that. I don't know what happens after we die, and frankly, I've kind of stopped worrying about it. I'm just trying to open up this idyllic notion that Jesus keeps talking about, because every time it comes up, it seems to be simultaneously more tangible and less concrete than what I was taught, at least. So I also think the notion of heaven is something other as opposed to something present allows us to disregard the present tense in favor of some better future. To me, it connects to this idea of children as the kingdom of heaven, children being the kingdom of heaven rather than it belonging to them. Heaven is evidenced in the way children move through the world, the way they trust in goodness, and the way they operate in good faith. So we're going to look at something from another movie. This is not a kids' movie necessarily, but it's a movie about kids. To Kill a Mockingbird. And so I think it's interesting because it also sort of, the way that the narrative is structured, it really comes at adult issues through the sort of view of children. So we're going to take a look at a scene where this sort of intrusion into the adult world by children, which the film is sort of built around, is sort of comes to a head. So if you haven't seen it, there's sort of a subplot in the movie about the kid's father, who's named Atticus Finch, is defending a man accused of rape. The man is black, the woman is white, and so he's the whole town is very upset that he's even getting a trial. And so in this scene, Atticus has heard that there is a lynch mob coming to the prison to lynch this man who's accused, and so he shows up there with his book, and he's going to sit there all night. And wait for these guys to show up and try and convince them not to do it. And what he doesn't realize is that his kids have also shown up at this moment. So we'll watch this quick.
That door, Mr. Finch?
Walter. I think you ought to turn right around and go back home. Big tape's around here somewhere.
No, he ain't.
Thanks. fixed up. We'll take her home with you. Son, I said go home.
No, sir.
Well, I'll set you home.
Let him go!
Let him go, son.
Ain't nobody gonna know the German matter why.
Are you gonna know you're Mr. Finch? Jim, I want you to please leave.
No, sir.
Jim?
I tell you, I ain't going.
Hey, Mr. Cunningham. I was thinking if you wanted to... I said, hey, Mr. Cunningham. How's your entertainment getting along? Don't you remember being Mr. Cunningham? I've seen the way he's finished. You brought us some hair cream nuts one early morning. Remember? We had a talk. I was got my daddy to come out and fuck you. I go to school with your boy. I go to school with Walter. He's a nice boy. Tell him pay for me, won't you? You have something, Mr. Cunningham? And tell him it's a day. And tell him it's... I was just saying, Mr. Cunningham, that entanglements were bad, but not to worry. Takes a long time sometimes. What's the matter? I sure might not know, Mr. Cunningham.
No harm taken, young lady. Now tell Walter you said, hey, let's clear out of here. Let's go, boys.
Okay, so what I find really incredible about this scene is that it is Scout's inability to not act like a child, her ability to operate in good faith, that completely diffuses the situation. We see two other adult approaches at play. First, Atticus tries to enforce his authority over the mob, who are attempting to enforce their notions of justice using their numbers. If each of these groups had had their way, it's likely that both Atticus and Tom Robinson, the man who is in prison, would have been dead at the end of the scene. It's also interesting to see that Jim, the older boy, who is the child that's nearest to adulthood, attempting this sort of nonviolent resistance tact that causes the mob to erupt with violence in reaction to him. It's only when Scout spots the man that she had had a conversation with earlier in the film and begins to speak with him that the situation dissipates. Scout clearly doesn't fully understand the racial and systemic drives behind the scenes of what she's encountered, but she recognizes a face of a person that has been kind to her in the past. Mr. Cunningham, while not a good person, after all he's part of a lynch mob, is still a person. And Scout, who is able to connect, with the humanity there. Her talk about Cunningham's debts, his entailments that she's talking about, works to not only humble Mr. Cunningham, along with most of the other men who are likely in similar financial situations. This is taking place in the 30s in the Deep South, so the Depression is on. But it also works to form a bond that transcends their sort of political differences. Scout is managing to move beyond the exterior to connect with the humanity that they share. So out of the discussion out of the discussion of children in the Bible, there comes this idea of having a sort of faith like a child, which again, if you're like me, you heard a lot about growing up. So like a lot of evangelical theology that I was brought up with, I came to discover that the notion has very little to do with what Christ actually taught. It's mostly taken from Matthew 18, where Jesus says, "I assure you, unless you turn from your sins and become as little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven." Now, if we consider the kingdom, if we consider heaven a specific place that you enter by having few sins or by having or enough faith to sort of counter those sins, then faith becomes a commodity of sorts, a tangible thing that can be measured, measurable, usable, and exhaustible. We can have certain amounts of it, and if we have enough stored up, then we'll be set in terms of the afterlife. So I'm guessing this is probably a familiar concept to a few of you, at least. I was taught this idea over and over again, and I always struggled because I've always had more doubt than faith. I have more questions than answers. I struggled constantly to have this childlike faith, which is not a phrase that appears in the Bible, by the way. I Bible Gateway searched it. Because even as a child, I had a lot of questions. So many that my Sunday school teachers, on more than one occasion, spoke to my parents in an attempt to stop me from asking so many questions in class. I was taught to see those questions as doubts, and doubt was the opposite of faith. So I never felt like I could fill up this faith tank enough to guarantee my entry into heaven, because every time I thought I believed something, doubt would creep back in. And I'm not talking about just believing in God or Jesus, but I struggled with all the other sorts of things that I was supposed to believe. Like that God would create billions of people that he knew would burn in hell for eternity. I went to a school, private school, that was so Calvinist that it was named after Calvin growing up. So that's where that idea came from. That my friend, who came out in high school and faced a great deal of ridicule and rejection, was only being gay for attention, and that if he would just be a better Christian or have more faith, he would be straight again. This is the thing I struggled with. I struggled with the fact that despite no evidence of miracles in my own life, I just had to believe that all the ones in the Bible were real, literally true. I struggled with the idea that I had to believe that the world was only 7,000 years old and created in a week, even though I had to dismiss mountains of evidence to the contrary. In the groups that I was sort of hung around with in my teenage years, having faith meant believing everything literally, unless anything else was to be thought of as a heathen. So I did what any good Christian boy would do. I lied endlessly to fit in. I couldn't figure out whether God was angrier at me for all that lying or for not believing that humans once kept dinosaurs as pets. I don't know. Maybe he's still mad about it. So this all came down to a misconception for me about the idea of faith. I believed that kids, or good kids, operated with some sense of blissful naivete because they believed whatever outrageous story they were told. I thought that that was what Jesus thought was great, being kind of dumb. And so I needed to be dumb in order to have a childlike faith and to be saved, whatever that means. But my whole concept of faith, I think, was flawed. Scout, in this scene in To Kill a Mockingbird, is operating out of faith. And it has nothing to do with the sort of mystical gas tank, but with a belief in others, even others in a lynch mob. And to believe that they are not, at their core, bad people, or at least people that want to do bad things. It's a tough concept to accept, and even say, kind of in our polarized age. But often, people's reprehensible behavior is born out of their belief in a toxic narrative. If a narrative can change, then so too can the behavior. Scout is changing the narrative here by speaking to the humanity at the heart of Mr. Cunningham's character. She mentions his son, Walter, who Scout goes to school with, and thus is opening the way to sympathy and human connection via shared experience. The narrative the men in this mob have been accepting up to this point was one of division, mostly along racial lines, and one that posits a black man as a rapist of a white woman, who, by merely being given a trial, was transgressing their idea of justice. Hence, they're on their way to perform their own version of justice by lynching him. sound a little bit like Batman. I don't know. Just make that connection there. Atticus Finch, in this moment, represents the law. And yet he, too, is ineffective, just as the law can be, especially towards marginalized groups. So just for anyone who hasn't sort of seen the whole movie or read the book, the law as a functioning thing doesn't come off too well in the narrative either. Atticus is a representation of an ideal version of the law, not necessarily the law we see in the movie, but he is thwarted by the prejudices of the men, and they're all men, by the way, on the jury in the later part of the film. So the end of the film and the book takes this and becomes this sort of fantastic contemplation of just what justice can even mean. So back to this scene, if Atticus is the law and the mob is the perverted sense of justice, Scout becomes the thing in between, this moment of grace, the ideal of faith. She operates in good faith. She has faith in goodness, and her humanity and innocence shame the men who operate out of a narrative of hatred and prejudice. This is that third way of thinking that Tim is talking about over the last couple months. This is that verse out of 1 Corinthians that said, God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise, chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. This is what faith can be and what it can do. And that is what I have learned from Atticus. My Atticus, not this Atticus, although a little bit from this Atticus. He has this sort of faith, as most children do, a belief in the goodness at the heart of others. It has nothing to do with having questions or doubts. Atticus has a lot of questions. My God, the questions. But he asks them with this belief that our answers, even if not correct, will be thoughtful and honest. As well, I'm not really the sort of person that likes to talk to people I don't know, but Atticus is that sort of person. And I've learned a lot from that. It makes me nervous for times when I'm not around. I'll be honest, it makes me even more nervous for times when I'm there, because it inevitably means that I too will have to have conversations with a stranger. Don't worry, we've talked lots about stranger danger. He's well up on that.
Mostly a myth anyways.
Yeah. So I can recognize that my reservations about talking to people come out of my own preconceived notions about who a person may be and what they may believe based on little more than their surface presentation, the way they look. I live in fear of confrontations with people of differing political beliefs in public spaces like McDonald's, but public spaces are where Atticus comes alive socially, as he turns to complete strangers and asks them if they like ice cream, or if they've heard of Charlie Chaplin, or if they like hamburgers or cheeseburgers better, or how they spend Christmas, or how many kids they have, or the worst, why don't you have any kids? I always feel a need to step in and rescue this poor person just trying to enjoy their lunch break. Yet I often find that the person doesn't mind all that much. Atticus has this incredible ability to engage with people, to make them laugh, sometimes to make them think. And it has everything to do with this ability that children have to embody what Jesus calls this kingdom of heaven through their faith in the goodness that surrounds them. And I, as a parent, have been privileged to partake in many delightful conversations with people that I otherwise never would have spoken to. Yet it goes beyond sort of pleasant talks. These moments remind me of the goodness in others and the ugliness in my own prejudices and preconceived notions. It's a chance to let a little faith re-enter my somewhat jaded soul. It's a child's ability to operate with a faith that is not a noun, a thing that can be accumulated on some cosmic scale, but rather with faith as something closer to a verb, a way of acting in the world, and a way of treating others that makes them an envoy to some better version of existence. They're this envoy to a heaven here on earth. As a parent, which as I said before, often feels like an exercise in failure, it's heartening to see that for the time being at least, Atticus also extends that same faith towards me. He believes in my ability, he believes in my love for him, even when I continuously fail to extend that grace towards him that he deserves. It is, I believe, the ability of children to act in good faith toward others that brings this modicum of grace into our lives and our interactions with others. These moments of good faith open up our minds and our hearts to our fellow humans and allow grace to transcend our anger, bitterness, and resentment. It is what we learn from these little embodiments of heaven, even though they often feel like embodiments of hell, that make us better parents, better partners, and better humans. So to close up, again, we don't have music, but I want to still have communion together. I'm going to take a little bit from another film, just as we sort of share communion together. If there's one thing besides failure that defines parenting for me, it would have to be this idea of patience. So I didn't really talk about the song we opened with, but that Cat Stevens song uses this idea of children at play as a way of sort of questioning the ideology of constant progress by reintroducing children into a world that has no space for them, right? Where the children play. Stevens is asking progress as a thing to suffer the children. And this is a question of patience. Can we slow down long enough to consider the least of these? Before I became a parent, I had no idea how much of my life would be spent waiting. I'm sure any parent here knows what I'm talking about. Before they're born, we wait for them to arrive. Once they're here, we wait for them to develop little personalities. As they get older, we wait for them to learn to walk, talk, read, ride a bike, tie their shoes, get through school, find someone to love, and start their own families. All the while, we dream and we hope, and we try to build a safe place for them to grow into, a place where they can develop into healthy and happy people. And I find this bit of film here really beautiful for the way it captures through the music, the dialogue, the images, and the precarious feeling of hope that comes in the waiting as the two characters here carefully consider the space that they want to bring their child into. So this clip's from a movie called The Way We Go. Came out probably like 10 years ago already. But you'll recognize Jim from The Office here and Maya Rudolph from many, many great things. And there's sort of, the whole movie is them traveling to different cities to sort of figure out where they want to start their life now that they're expecting a baby. And so in the end of the movie, we're coming back to what was Maya Rudolph's childhood home, So we can watch this. You don't need much more context than that, but just sort of enjoy it and think about what it's saying, and we'll take communion while we do that.